2019 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you be better prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In this episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovells partner Mike Tice from our Denver office and Senior Associate Jennifer Breckbill from our Washington, D.C. office as they discuss the AseraCare decision.
Hello, I'm Mike Tice. I'm a partner with Hogan Lovells in the Investigations White Collar and Fraud practice in Denver, Colorado.
And I'm Jennifer Breckbill. I'm a Senior Associate in the Investigations White Collar and Fraud practice, and I'm based out of Washington, D.C.
And today, Jennifer, we're here to talk about the 11th Circuit opinion in United States versus AseraCare. This is an opinion that was published by the 11th Circuit in September of this year, and it comes more than 2 years after the district court in this case granted summary judgment for the defendant, who was a hospice provider, in a case brought under the False Claims Act, originally by Quitom Relators and then later joined by the United States, alleging that the hospice provider falsely certified patients as eligible under the Medicare program, under the hospice benefit in the Medicare program. District court granted summary judgment. It goes up to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit vacates in part and remands the case to the district court. The government won in the 11th Circuit, was able to vacate summary judgment for the defendant, and it's back in the district court. This looks like a win for the government to me. So I guess my first question to you, Jennifer, is what's the fuss about this case? If the government won, what's the big deal here?
I think there's a fuss because there's a big question as to whether the government actually won. I think this might be a situation where the government won the battle, but perhaps lost the war. And this is because, you know, in finding for the government in that sense, the court also made very clear throughout its opinion that a mere difference of medical opinion without more objective proof of falsity can't give rise to a false claim. Instead, you need something tangible. And what's more, you need to be able to tie any evidence of corporate scheme or any, you know, intentional wrongdoing to the actual claims at issue in the case. So it raises the bar for the government to be able to win at the end of the day.
Okay, so the 11th Circuit holds that the government has to be able to prove objective falsity of the claims and that a mere difference of clinical opinion is not enough to establish that objective falsity. How did that issue become crystallized for the 11th Circuit to decide? What's the procedural backdrop here that got this issue teed up for the 11th Circuit to decide?
So procedurally, the district court granted summary judgment because it had found that it gave the wrong instructions to the jury on falsity. So that's what teed this issue up for the 11th Circuit.
So let's back up a little bit and talk about that. The procedural posture was unusual in the district court for another reason, too, as I recall. This is a case where the defendant had moved for summary judgment, and the court denied that motion for summary judgment. But in so doing, the court also invited the defendant to file a motion to bifurcate and to separate the issue of falsity from the other elements of False Claims Act proof, knowledge and damages and so forth. What happened there?
You know, what the government has been saying is we have all of these claims that we think are false. In particular, specifically, they say 123 claims that they think are false. And further, they wanted to be able to extrapolate those claims to a much larger universe. So they're saying we have, you know, corporate scheme evidence, we have all of this suggestion of wrongdoing here, and we're going to use that to say that these 123 claims are false.
I had a hospice fraud case that was pending at the time, and I actually went down to Birmingham, Alabama, to watch the motions for summary judgment get argued in front of Judge Karen Bowdre, who presided over the district court and who has this case back in front of her on remand. And, you know, I have to say that I thought that the defendants had done a very good job in discovery and motions of making the point that the certification of eligibility for hospice is unique, that the that the hospice regulation gives a lot of deference to the certifying physician's clinical judgment. And the defendants had argued effectively that the government was really trying to conflate different elements of a False Claims Act violation. It was trying to conflate evidence of knowledge with evidence of falsity. And their point was, look, these are subjective clinical judgments that go into prognosticating, predicting a life expectancy of 6 months or less, which is the standard for eligibility for hospice. And the court really seemed to be very concerned about that idea that, you know, that the government was trying to bring in this pattern and practice evidence and that could in some way prejudice the jury that would eventually hear this case on the question of falsity. Judge Baudry was very troubled by this, by just the only evidence of falsity, if you disregard the pattern and practice evidence, was this difference of clinical opinion. Nevertheless, she bifurcates and it goes forward on this issue of falsity as to, as you pointed out, a subset of the claims. And what's interesting about that to me is the government started with a universe of over 2,000 patients for whom AseraCare had billed at least a year of hospice eligibility. In other words, you know, the patients lived too long from the government's perspective. And then from that set of, I think it was 2,180 patients, they selected 223 to review. Their expert boiled that down to the 123 that became basically the test case. But what happened on the phase one trial and what was the jury's finding with respect to those 123 claims?
Yeah, so the jury actually found in favor of the government, which, you know, made the district court's decision then to grant summary judgment all that much more powerful. You know, one thing that you raised, which I think is really interesting, is how unique the certification requirements are in this case and how they rely on physician judgment so explicitly. So I guess one question I have for you is kind of, what does this mean? You know, we've dealt with hospice clients in particular, and, you know, we've worried about AseraCare so much in that context, but what does that mean for other clients who are in the life sciences?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I mean, I think there is a tendency to relegate this decision to, you know, something that is applicable only in the hospice context. And I think certainly that that's the something that the government is going to want to do, you know, to say, look, the certification requirement is unique. And it is, in a way, it is unusual to have a physician certification that deals with a prediction of future events. Instead of being a certification as to a diagnosis that is present today, you are making a certification as to a prognosis, a prediction about when a patient will die at some point in the future. But notwithstanding that, I think that the opinion, the 11th Circuit opinion, is important for a number of reasons. And I think that it may still have application outside of the hospice context. First, this requirement of proving objective falsity is important. And this is not something that you know, comes up only in this case. You know, the rejection of expressions of opinion or scientific judgment or statements as to conclusions about which reasonable minds can differ, a number of different courts have said in one way or the other that's not enough to establish falsity for purposes of the False Claims Act. Another thing that I think is important from this decision and that is portable to other cases is this requirement of a nexus between pattern and practice evidence and the individual claims that are being considered by the jury. If there is, in fact, some requirement of linking that pattern and practice evidence to the specific claims, that you have to do more than simply adduce pattern and practice evidence and then say, well, the claims must be false because look at the, you know, how sloppy the business practices were. If you have to show how those business practices connect to the specific claims, that I think is a slightly higher burden on the government. And I think there is also a higher burden for the government in using sampling and extrapolation, particularly where the issue is one that is subjective.
I think that's right. And that last point, I think, is going to be meaningful for a lot of our clients in this space, whether or not they're hospice companies, because, you know, right now, the whole issue of sampling and extrapolation to prove liability is it's so uncertain, and we don't have any strong circuit court decisions that permit it or disallow it. And it's something that, especially in the False Claims Act area, it could have huge ramifications for our clients with treble damages. It's really something that could, and this sounds dramatic, but could really ruin a company if a case were to go to trial and sampling and extrapolation were permitted to be used for liability purposes rather than just damages. It's something that could put a lot of companies in danger.
So let me play devil's advocate on that for a minute. I think defendants in just about any case could make this argument, could say, look, the issues are so unique here, the judgments are so subjective that you really have to prove the case up on a claim-by-claim basis. You can't use sampling and extrapolation to prove the case, particularly when you're dealing with a question of knowing presentation of a false claim. You have this element that is required, and that imposes a higher burden on the government to show that each claim is false. I think that a statistician would say, well, that's just, nonsense. You can use sampling and extrapolation in any context where there is a large number of claims or a large data set of some kind, and you want to draw inferences generally about that population of claims. And the fact that each individual decision is subjective or unique really doesn't matter because, what we're talking about here is just math. And moreover, this is critically important to courts that are trying to decide not only False Claims Act cases, but any number of different types of cases where there are large numbers of claims that have to be resolved. You simply can't expect a court to devote the amount of time and energy and resources that would be required to decide cases on a claim-by-claim basis if we can get expert testimony and, of course, subject that testimony to the usual tests of admissibility. But if we can get admissible expert testimony that allows us to draw conclusions about a large population from looking at a sample, courts have to be able to do that. Why is that wrong?
The reason it's wrong is because cases like this, where we're talking about medical judgment, it lacks the same certainty that other cases have. So if you have a doctor who's falsifying records, that's an objective falsity that you can then extrapolate from. Here, we're dealing with such uncertain judgments in the first place that it makes the extrapolation much less certain and meaningful.
How do we make conclusions about where the principles from AseraCare are going to get some additional traction and where are the cases that are sufficiently different? Maybe you can come up with some obvious examples where you have a case that involves, for example, upcoding. Billing for code number one, where you should really bill for code number two, which pays a lower amount.
Right now, it's fairly common to be able to use sampling and extrapolation for all types of cases, whether it's objective, clear-cut cases of falsity or cases that are more along the lines of medical judgment. It's generally permissible to use sampling and extrapolation for damages, but the law is much less clear when it comes to liability, and it's actually an issue that courts have kind of punted on in the past.
So what has happened on remand? The case is now back in the district court, and how is the government trying to proceed on this group of 123 claims that they ultimately adduced in what would have been the falsity phase of the trial in the district court before it went up on appeal?
It's actually very interesting. I think the activity that we've seen since the 11th Circuit's opinion shows that that opinion wasn't an end to the case. It really is marking a new chapter in AseraCare. And just, in the past couple of months, the government filed a motion asking to reopen limited medical expert discovery. And they did this for the limited purpose of obtaining an additional medical expert to testify that no reasonable physician would have certified the 123 patients at issue. And of course, this idea came from the 11th Circuit opinion that said that one way to prove objective falsity would be to show that no reasonable physician would have said that a patient was eligible. But the court, on the district court level, denied this request. And they did so for two primary reasons.
So on remand, the court is not permitting the government to reopen expert testimony to allow this evidence that the 11th Circuit suggested it could adduce to prove that no reasonable physician could have concluded that the patient was terminally ill.
Yes, the district court has to look at all of the evidence, but it only has to look at the evidence that's already in the record. What the district court said was, we don't have to consider evidence that the government could possibly offer in the future. We just have to look at the record as it is now. And the second, and perhaps more interesting reason was that basically the court said no, because it just didn't find good cause. In fact, it seemed to really find fault with the government for not at least planning for this possibility earlier. You know, this is, you talked a little bit about the procedural history. This is a case that's been around for about a decade. And, you know, as early as 2012, AseraCare was making arguments about no reasonable physician and that they would have to prove objective falsity in this way. So the government was really on notice. So it kind of, to the extent that the government is framing this as a win, the district court seemed to be, you know, taking the government to task on that.
So what do you think the key takeaways are for our clients in cases like this?
I think there are four main takeaways. You know, I think based on the 11th Circuit opinion, we see that there are fewer circumstances that can give rise to FCA liability in healthcare cases involving differences of medical opinion. And the 11th Circuit outlines three potential avenues, although that's not a limiting holding. Second, the point that you just made about supporting documentation, I think that's a very important takeaway that could become relevant for a lot of our clients, even outside of the hospice industry. Third, we talked a little bit about, you know, how relators and the government are going to now face greater difficulty in using evidence of a corporate scheme to prove falsity if they're required to link that evidence to specific claims. And fourth, and this is, I think, one of the most exciting avenues is, you know, how can clients use this language and this rhetoric to potentially argue against the use of sampling and extrapolation in the future? So I think those are the four main takeaways.
I think that that's right, although I continue to think that, you know, this battle about sampling and extrapolation is one that has been going on in False Claims Act cases is for as long as I have been litigating them, which is far too long. And, you know, these same kinds of arguments have been raised in these cases repeatedly. And as I alluded to earlier, I think that the courts only have a limited appetite for rejecting sampling and extrapolation because I think that the courts generally see this as a way of expediting consideration of these kinds of cases and trying to reduce the amount of court resources and the parties' time and resources as well to get to a result. So anything else that you think that is important here?
I think we're just going to have to keep tracking AseraCare. I think this isn't over, and there's still potentially a lot more that we can learn from this case.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Jennifer. This has been our discussion of the AseraCare case. We thank you so much for tuning in, and we look forward to talking to you again soon about other developments in False Claims Act litigation.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the False Claims Act, please download our latest publication, FCA Guide 2019 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.